Hello and welcome to our quarterly podcast discussing activities to support consistent application. And this podcast covers the first quarter of 2022. I'm Petrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and I'm here today for the first time, in fact, with the new chair of the Interpretations Committee, Bruce McKenzie. Welcome, Bruce. So in today's podcast, we're going to cover discussions at February and March Interpretations Committee meetings, as well as a brief update on a few ISB narrow scope projects. And there's a lot to get through, so I'm going to start today, as ever, with finalised agenda decisions. And there were two discussed. And Bruce, I'm going to hand over to you to ask you to remind listeners about the first of those, which was on restricted cash.
Thanks, Petrina, and thanks to everybody for tuning in and listening to the work that the Interpretations Committee has been doing. The first of the ones we're going to take a look at is on demand deposits with restricted use. Now, this is a question about cash held in a demand deposit that has been earmarked for a specified purpose. So the facts are that an entity has a demand deposit account and can access the amounts held in the account whenever it wishes to. But the entity also has a contractual obligation with a third party to keep a specified amount of cash in that demand deposit and to use that cash only for a specified purpose. Now, the entity would breach its contract with the third party if it chooses to use that cash for anything other than the specified purpose. Now, the question asked was whether the entity presents the demand deposit as cash and cash equivalents in its cash flow statement and balance sheet, or whether the contractual restrictions on the use of the cash means that the amounts held are no longer cash for IFRS purposes. So the committee said that in this fact pattern, the amounts held in the demand deposit are cash as defined by I7. Now, that definition focuses only on the nature of the item. If the nature is that of a demand deposit or cash in hand, then the item is cash. And in the facts discussed by the committee, the demand deposit is just that, a demand deposit. The entity can access the amounts held in the deposit on demand. Now, the terms of the contract with the third party have no effect on the entity's ability to access the amounts held on deposit.
Great, thanks, Bruce. In a number of comment letters the committee received, respondents mentioned the definition of cash equivalents, an IS7. And raised questions about why, in the fact pattern discussed, the contractual restrictions don't change the classification of the demand deposit, it's still cash, but if there were similar restrictions on deposit that's not a demand deposit, then those restrictions might prevent the deposit from being classified as cash equivalents. Why is that?
Well, Petrina, it's because the definition of cash and cash equivalents are not the same. The definition of cash focuses only on the nature of the item. So if the amounts are in the deposit and accessible on demand, then the amounts are cash. But to be classified as cash equivalents, both the nature and purpose matter. Remember, I7 says that the cash equivalents must be held for the purpose of meeting the short-term cash commitments. If there are restrictions preventing an entity from using the amounts to meet these short-term cash commitments, then those amounts cannot be cash equivalents. So in the particular fact pattern discussed, the demand deposit is cash, even though there are restrictions on its use. Now, the agenda decision highlighted disclosure requirements that would apply, which are particularly important because the entity has cash that it cannot freely use.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. So that agenda decision will be discussed by the ISB in April. And if the ISB doesn't object, then it will be published in April. So if I move on to the second finalised agenda decision, which has actually already been published in March, and that's because the ISB already discussed it in March, and it's on the complicated topic of TLTRO III loans that have been provided by the European Central Bank to banks. Now, I'm only going to mention this one briefly because it's quite a niche topic, but it involved both IFRS 9 and IAS 20. And maybe why IAS 20? Because if the ECB is considered government, as defined in IAS 20, and if the terms of the loan are such that it's a forgivable loan or it's a loan given at a below market rate, then a portion of the loan might be accounted for in IAS 20, while the rest of that loan would be within the scope of IFRS 9. So the committee did not opine on whether a portion of these TLTRO III loans are in the scope of IAS 20. That requires judgment. But the agenda decision does set out the questions a bank receiving loans from the ECB would ask itself in determining the required accounting. So if Telstra 3 loans are of interest to you, then please go to our website and have a read of the agenda decision on this topic, which, as I said, was published in March. So we're now going to move on to the new topics discussed in February and March. And it somehow seems appropriate to start with the first IFRS 17 question that the committee discussed. So, and this IFRS 17 question was on the topic of the allocation of the contractual service margin, or CSM, for a group of annuity contracts. So in the fact pattern submitted, an insurer has issued a group of insurance contracts under which the policyholder pays a premium upfront and receives an even payment each year for as long as they live. So let's say it's £100 per year for as long as the policyholder lives. So the policyholder is receiving insurance coverage for survival, and that's the only service being provided to the policyholder. And the question the committee was asked was about the recognition of profit on this group of annuity contracts. So Bruce, can you tell us all a bit more about this question?
Thanks, Petrina. First of all, it might be useful to explain to listeners what the CSM is and then explain the question. So in IFRS 17, the CSM represents the unearned profit in a group of insurance contracts, and that unearned profit is included in the measure of the group of contracts. Now, IFRS 17 requires an insurer to recognize the CSM in profit or loss as it provides the insurance contract services to policyholders. So the amount of the CSM recognized in profit and loss in the period must reflect the insurance contract services provided to policyholders in that period, in a very similar way to how we recognize revenue to reflect the services transferred to a customer in a period under IFRS 15. The question the committee was asked was about how to recognize the CSM to reflect the insurance coverage for survival provided in the annuity contracts described in the request. The request had identified two possible ways of recognizing the CSM and asked whether both would meet the principle of reflecting the insurance coverage provided in each period. Now, the committee concluded that a method based on the amount of the annuity payment the policyholder is able to validly claim in a period would meet the principle in IFRS 17. However, a method based on the present value of expected future annuity payments would not, because it would misrepresent the service provided in the current period by considering amounts the policyholder could claim and benefit from only in future periods. Now, I would highlight that the question asked only about the insurance coverage for survival, so this is what the committee discussed and reached conclusions on. The committee did not discuss how the insurer would recognize the risk adjustment for non-financial risk on these contracts, nor did it discuss what the insurer would need to do to consider if the contract also provided other insurance contract services.
Great, thanks, Bruce. Now, there's a couple of questions I've heard about on this submission that I think listeners might be interested in. So the first is about the committee's conclusion. So I've heard some say that, well, IFRS 17 is surely a principles-based standard, so judgment will be required to apply it. And in fact, in this instance, the tentative agenda decision itself notes that IFRS 17 does not prescribe a method for recognising the CSM and profit or loss. So how could the committee conclude that one of the methods submitted is inappropriate?
That's a good question, and one I'm glad you've asked. So people are right that IFRS 17 is a principles-based standard and judgment is required, but I point out that principles-based does not mean that anything goes. In this particular case, IFRS 17 requires an insurer to recognize the CSM in profit and loss to reflect the insurance contract services provided in each period. So it is true that different methods of recognition may achieve that principle depending on the fact pattern, and IFRS 17 doesn't prescribe one method because there's no one-size-fits-all method that would reflect the services provided in every insurance contract. However, the method applied must be one that reflects the services provided. For this particular fact pattern, the committee concluded that the one of these methods described failed to reflect the insurance coverage provided in each period. Now, that's the committee's tentative conclusion, which obviously is out now for comment. So we look forward to hearing from those who are interested in it.
Now, the next question, Bruce, I've heard is really a question about why is the committee discussing IFRS 17 questions now? We're in 2022. It's less than a year from the effective date. So surely the committee discussing IFRS 17 could only be disruptive to insurers' implementation efforts.
Yeah, it's another good question, and one we could obviously talk about for quite a while, but let's keep it brief. I'd like to say that we as an organization do not actively seek to become involved in implementation questions when a standard is so close to the effective date. We're very active just after a major standard is issued, but we realize that the closer we get to the effective date, the more disruptive our involvement could possibly be. So we encourage the markets to work together to resolve implementation questions without us needing to be involved. However, if the market is unable to resolve the questions, and these questions are obviously really matter, then the committee's process is there to help. And this was the case with respect to the annuity contracts in question. The question was submitted after the market made the best efforts to resolve these questions, but couldn't do so. Now, secondly, I'd also note that the process adopted on IFRS 17 is no different to that adopted on our other major new standards, such as IFRS 9 or IFRS 15. For those standards, the committee also considered questions that arose in the period before their effective date. Now, finally, a benefit of the committee's process is that the stakeholders have the opportunity to be involved via the comment letter process. And if changes needed as a result of the agenda decision, companies are entitled to sufficient time to implement those changes. So at this stage, insurers are unlikely to be expected to implement any changes by 2023. But if we deal with the question now, then they might be able to if they wish to. Remember, dealing with a question now could be seen as better than waiting until, say, a year from now, when potentially it's going to cause a lot more change.
Great. Thanks very much, Bruce, for picking up those extra questions as well. So we have spent quite some time in IFRS 17, but I think it was important. But I'll now try to move us along a bit more quickly. So the next topic that has actually already been out for comment in a tentative agenda decision relates to IAS 37 and whether an entity has an obligation in relation to negative low emission vehicle credits. So really, I think this is a great example of how and why climate is already affecting entities when they're preparing their financial statements. So in this fact pattern, regulations have been put in place to encourage entities to import or produce more energy efficient vehicles in a particular jurisdiction. Now, all importers and producers of passenger vehicles must sign up to the regulation. Entities receive negative credits if they import or produce vehicles whose emission levels exceed targets set by the government, and they receive positive credits if they do the opposite. So the regulation requires an entity to eliminate its net negative credits, either by purchasing positive credits or generating its own positive credits in the future. And if the entity fails to eliminate negative credits, then the government can impose sanctions on the entity. So what the submitter asked was whether an entity that has generated negative credits has a present obligation that would meet the definition of a liability in IAS 37. And the committee said, yes, in this particular fact pattern, such an entity has an obligation that meets the definition of a liability unless accepting the sanctions is a realistic alternative to eliminating the negative credits for the entity. The tentative agenda decision explains the committee's rationale in detail. It explains that the activity that gives rise to the obligation is the production or import of vehicles, that the generation of positive credits in the future, that's a means of settling the obligation, and such settlement involves an outflow of economic resources. And it also explains that the obligation exists independently of the entity's future actions. Now, I think this one, by the way, the committee had a really good discussion on it, and I do imagine it's going to generate a lot of interest in the form of comment letters. So I think I can imagine we're going to be picking this one up in more detail in a future podcast. So moving very quickly on from IAS 37 to my favourite standard, which is, of course, IFRS 16, and a question that cuts across both IFRS 9 and IFRS 16, and it's related to rent concessions. So in the particular fact pattern submitted, a lessor grants a rent concession to a lessee, of course, that changes a lease that the lessor has classified as an operating lease. And the only change to that lease is that the lessor legally releases the lessee from its obligation to make specifically identified lease payments. Or in other words, there's actual legal extinguishment of some of the contractual lease payments. And some of those payments forgiven had actually been recognised by the lessor as an operating lease receivable. So the committee was asked two questions on this fact pattern. First of all, how does the lessor apply the expected credit loss or ECL model in IFRS 9 to the operating lease receivable when it expects to forgive lease payments, but the concession hasn't actually yet been granted? And secondly, whether the lessor applies the derecognition requirements in IFRS 9 or the lease modification requirements in IFRS 16 in accounting for the rent concession. So Bruce, I'm again going to hand over to you to explain, but a warning, by the way, you must promise to be kind to IFRS 16.
I'm always kind to IFRS 16. So first, to make the question a bit more real, picture a three-year lease contract where the lessee pays £100 per month over 36 months. At the end of the first year of the lease, the last three payments have not been made, so the lessor has an operating lease receivable of £300. The lessor then grants a concession that means the lessee is no longer obliged to pay those last three payments for year one, nor is it obliged to pay the first two payments for year two. So in this example, the committee first of all said that the lessor must apply the ECL model in IFRS 9 to the operating lease receivable from when it recognizes that receivable. So the ECL model is applied in the period before the rent concession is granted. And in applying the ECL model, the lessor would measure the expected credit loss in a way that reflects an unbiased and probability-weighted amount, including consideration of its expectation of forgiving the lease payments. So in my example, the lessor would measure the expected credit losses in a way that would include considering its expectation of forgiving the £300 recognized as an operating lease receivable. Something important to highlight. The ECL model, and in particular the definition of credit loss in IFRS 9, does not say that the credit losses are only those that arise from a credit event. A credit loss includes all cash shortfalls, which is the difference between all contractual payments included in the gross receivable and all cash flows the entity expects to receive. Then, on granting the concession, the lessor would account for it by applying the derecognition requirements in IFRS 9 to the amounts forgiven in the receivable. So again, using my example, the lessor would apply the IFRS 9 derecognition requirements to the £300 forgiven that it had recognized as an operating lease receivable. And it would apply the lease modification requirements in IFRS 16 to the remaining payments forgiven. In my example, the first two payments for year two.
Great. So that lessor rent concession question is also now out for comment in a tentative agenda decision. And again, we look forward to hearing from you on it. Now, in this topic, the committee was also asked about the lessee's accounting for the rent concession that we just discussed. And for the lessee, the committee recommended that the ISB consider whether to undertake narrow scope standard setting and possibly as an annual improvement. So we'll not discuss that today, but we'll cover it in a future podcast when the ISB talks about the topic in the future. Okay, so moving on to another topical area, and actually two new questions the committee received on SPAC transactions. Now, SPACs have recently occupied and continue to occupy press headlines, but they're not entities that everyone has necessarily heard of. So just for clarity, I'll first of all explain that SPACs are special purpose acquisition companies. They're typically listed on a stock exchange, set up for the purpose of acquiring a not yet identified target company, and they often have a limited life. So before acquiring a target company, SPACs often hold little other than cash, which the SPAC will have received from investors in exchange for instruments issued by the SPAC. And the first question the committee received was about shares issued by a SPAC and whether those shares should be classified as financial liabilities or equity when applying IAS 32. Now, the committee noted that this specific question asked really fits very much into a broader topic that is currently being considered by the ISB as part of its FICE project. So the committee said it's really best for the ISB to deal with that question as part of the FICE project. The second question that the committee was asked about SPACs was about how to account for warrants when a target operating company acquires a SPAC. Now, anybody listening closely might think I'm confusing you because I said just recently, that SPACs are typically set up to acquire a target company, and yet the fact pattern here is one where the SPAC is being acquired. And I suppose, in short, these types of transactions can actually happen or be done in different ways. Legally, the SPAC might acquire an operating company, or the reverse can happen. Legally, the operating company can acquire the SPAC. And in fact, the accounting will very much depend on the specific terms and conditions of the acquisition. But in the specific fact pattern the committee discussed, it is one where the SPAC had issued warrants to both its founder shareholders and public investors at the time that it was set up and listed. And then when it was acquired, the operating company that acquired it issued new warrants to replace the warrants that had been issued by the SPAC. So the question was, how should the operating company account for the warrants on acquiring the SPAC? Now, Bruce, this question is both for me super interesting, by the way, but also super complicated. And I think it would take us some time to even properly explain the fact pattern. So I'm going to make it difficult for you. I'm going to hand over to you and ask you if you could say something brief on this. That is, of course, both understandable, but also piques listeners' interest to really go and read the tentative agenda decision.
So, Petrina, if I have to be brief, what are the highlights? First of all, the question and why does it matter? Now, the question asks specifically about how the operating company accounts for the warrants it issues at the time of the acquisition. And that matters because, again, it's about whether the warrants are classified as financial liabilities or equity. Now, why does the question arise? Well, it's a transaction that cuts across several IFRS accounting standards. So to really get to the bottom of how to account for these transactions, the operating company needs to think through the analysis step by step. And that's what the tentative agenda decision does. So the first question is, who's the acquirer? Well, who controls after the acquisition? Is it the operating company or the SPAC? In our fact pattern, the acquirer was the operating company. The next question is it a business combination? And if so, IFRS 3 applies. In our fact pattern, the SPAC was not a business, so it was not an acquisition under IFRS 3 and business combinations did not apply. Now, in that case, it's the acquisition of a group of assets, and paragraph 2B of IFRS 3 says that the operating company must identify and recognize the assets acquired and the liabilities assumed. The next question then is, what about the assets acquired and the liabilities assumed? The SPAC company acquires the SPAC's cash but does not acquire anything else. And the steps continue on. So we've laid out the steps that need to be thought through as you're working through these. Now, to get to the punchline, I think the tentative agenda decision does a great job of setting out how an entity needs to think through these transactions, which instruments are being exchanged for which assets and liabilities, to then work out which requirements apply and how to account for the transaction. If you remember only one thing from what we've said on SPACs today, it's this. Instruments issued in exchange for cash or another financial asset on the scope of IAS 32, whereas instruments issued in exchange for goods and services on the scope of IFRS 2 share-based payments. Remember, goods and services do not include cash or other financial assets.
Thank you, Bruce. So again, we've just sort of quite rapidly gone through various tentative agenda decisions that are now out for comment. Most of the new topics we've talked about today will be out for comment until the 23rd of May. So I want to advertise those today and really ask you to get involved and send the committee comment letters to the extent any of those topics are of interest to you. So finally, a very brief update on the ISB's work supporting consistent application. Now, in the last podcast, we discussed the ISB's project on lease liabilities in a sale and leaseback. And on that one, the ISB had decided on the way forward in December, and in February, it signed off on the due process requirements, and we're now into drafting. So listeners, you can expect to see final amendments on the sale and leaseback requirements in IFRS 16 sometime around September this year. The second topic is to mention, or the next two projects, is really just to highlight that the comment periods for both of the ISB's narrow scope projects, first of all on non-current liabilities with covenants, and secondly on supplier finance arrangements, both ended at the end of March. So I can tell you that you all and our stakeholders in general have been very busy writing us comment letters, which is really great. There's a lot of comment letters on both projects now up on our website. So the ISB will actually start to consider those comments in the coming months. So there we are, a whirlwind through mainly the committee's activities in the first quarter. That brings our podcast to a close today. Thank you, Bruce, for joining me today. I hope you will come back again. Thank you all for listening, and please email communications@ifrs.org if you have any suggestions for improvement. So take care, thank you, and goodbye.